The following is part one in a two-part episode here on Tales from the South.
This is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. She's everything that a country boy would need. And look here, boy, she's staring back at me. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Arkansas's premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, have won multiple awards, and their music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces and HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. What do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, we're in a church. And our storytellers all bring us their own church stories, from the historical to the comical and much more. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Thomas Fraze has to give a wake-up call. Then Jason Pennington problem solves. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Joanna Seibert at a church full of history in Memphis in Extraordinary Differences.
My husband and I are beyond 60 in years. In fact, well beyond. We jokingly say that we do four things every week. We go out to eat with friends. We go to church. We go to the doctor. And we go to funerals. Recently, we returned to Memphis for the funeral of Phyllis Tickle, one of today's best-selling authors and speakers on American faith and spirituality, who also takes time from her amazing schedule to be a mentor and supporter of my own writing. Perhaps her best-known work, The Great Emergence, chronicles the great upheaval in the Christian church every 500 years, leading to a new and vibrant Christianity that still recovers part of the past, carrying them into the future. Her memorial service is at St. Mary's Cathedral, the South's first cathedral, built in 1871. We arrive early and sit in the middle pews near the center aisle in the massive gray stone cathedral as the ushers are just putting out the service bulletins and opening the doors. And the cathedral canon, the assistant priest, is marking the reserved pews for the family. In this stained glass quiet memorial flood in nonstop waves about our connection with Phyllis, our connection to this holy place, and our connection to those who have served here before us. St. Mary's is the church where my husband and I are confirmed as Episcopalians while we are interns at the City of Memphis Hospitals. Inside these Gothic walls, our two sons are baptized, one as a year-old toddler after his father returns from Vietnam, and the other as a six-week-old infant before we leave Memphis to continue our medical journey to Iowa and then to Arkansas. We could not be married in the Episcopal Church in the 1960s, as marriage between divorced couples was not then allowed in that diocese. We happen, however, to be married on October 18th, the feast day of St. Luke, the patron saint of physicians and this church. And we are among the few that morning in the Saturday Eucharist for St. Luke's at St. Mary's Chapel just before our wedding at the Unitarian Church on the river. St. Mary's Cathedral is well known for several ordinary parishioners and clergy who have made extraordinary differences in lives, past and present. First, there are the Episcopal nuns, Constance and her companions, who stay in Memphis at St. Mary's in 1878 during the height of the yellow fever epidemic, when over 5,000 people die and Memphis loses its charter due to the loss of population. The sisters die as they care for the sick, and their names are later memorialized on the great marble high altar and the steps to it at the highest point in the cathedral. I'm now distracted as I see today's crucifer move the large processional cross to the back of the church as the organ and violin prelude slowly begins with the familiar, somniferous, soaring melody for today's service. We can't remember the name of the more modern composition, but it moves me back again to when my husband and I were senior medical students in Memphis when Martin Luther King is assassinated. The dean of this cathedral in that era is William Dimmick, who, like Phyllis, is a mentor and friend and is instrumental in bringing us into the church during a period when we both feel so damaged. Dean Dimmick takes this same St. Mary's processional cross out of the church and leads a group of clergy down Poplar Avenue to Mayor Henry Loeb's office, asking for an end to the sanitation workers' strike, which brought King to Memphis. Nearly half of the cathedral's congregation eventually leave because of Dean Dimmick's action. More martyrs in Memphis. Today's adult acolytes now light the candles about the historic high altar and walk past their seats behind the choir stalls. My flight of ideas jets back to younger acolytes who serve when we attend St. Mary's in the early 1970s. They're adolescent sons of one of the other priests at St. Mary's, Cham Cannon. They often leave their almost hidden seats during the service to go to the vestry room behind the choir and the altar and do whatever acolytes do. Get a drink of water, go to the restroom, get more bread, wine, water for the Eucharist. At one particular Sunday service, one of the young boys, remember, only males are acolytes in the 70s, happens to look out of the back window and sees the adjacent rundown house on fire. He calls the fire department, goes into the house, brings out an elderly black woman to safety, and then returns to the cathedral just in time to light and carry out the processional torches with the closing hymn. Most of the congregation knows little about what happens until reading about in the Commercial Appeal newspaper the next day. The procession of today's choir and clergy and Phyllis's family begins, and the canon is reciting the funeral anthems for our friend and mentor, as all are led by acolytes carrying those same torches used by Cham Cannon's sons, and that same processional cross once carried by Dean Dimmick down Poplar Avenue, all now moving slowly to the altar, which remembers the yellow fever martyrs of Memphis, where we will now celebrate the life of a woman who has touched lives today and for the next 500 years to come.
Joanna Seibert is an ordained deacon assigned to St. Luke's Episcopal Church in North Little Rock and is a recently retired physician in pediatric radiology at Arkansas Children's Hospital and UAMS after practicing medicine for 47 years. Next on Tales from the South, let's head down to a small Methodist church with Thomas Fraze in Come to Life.
One Sunday after church, one of my congregants, Geraldine, approached me.
"Brother Tom, may I ask you something?" she said in her soft southern voice.
"Sure," I said. She pulled me to the corner of the church and she lowered her already soft voice.
"Brother Tom, can you tell when someone goes to sleep during the service?"
I took a moment to weigh my response, but I knew an opportunity had presented itself. "Geraldine, of course I can see when someone goes to sleep. I'm looking right at them, and they are no more than 10 feet away. I watch them the whole service. I probably know they're asleep before they know they're asleep." She nodded and I went on my way. I guessed her husband, Richard, may not enjoy his lunch too much today. I am an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church of Arkansas. That means that I am an itinerant pastor, and that means the bishop of my conference appoints me to my ministry position. Or to say it more plainly, the bishop tells me where to go, and I go. My first appointment out of seminary was to, as they say in my business, a two-point charge in South Arkansas. I had pastoral authority over the First United Methodist Church of Stamps and Sardis United Methodist Church. The town of Stamps, famous as the childhood home of Maya Angelou, had a population of about 2,000 people. But at one time, Stamps was a thriving quasi-metropolis boasting of the world's largest sawmill. Of course, when I arrived, the sawmill was long gone, and as was the YMCA, the opera house, movie theater, car dealerships, and most of the population. About 90 good folks attended worship services each Sunday at First United Methodist Church, and so I considered this my big church. My small church was Sardis United Methodist Church. It had been around since before the Civil War, and while it was only 4 miles from Stamps, and all of its congregants grew up and went to school with all the folks from Stamps, each church had its own identity and place in Lafayette County. The Sardis Church sat across the street from the Sardis Cemetery. The Sardis United Methodist Church was the keeper of the cemetery and the keeper of the remnant of the rural community that used to farm and fellowship together there. You've seen this church many times if you've ever driven the rural roads of Arkansas. White clad, neat yard, small steeple, about the size of a small home. Inside, there was a small chancellery and about 20 pews with 10 on each side of a single aisle. It would seat many more people than were ever seated there while I served them. Each Sunday, between 8 and 12 people would sit on one side of the small church. The youngest couple in the congregation was about 65, and the oldest couple almost 90 years old. Each Sunday, after singing and prayer in the collection, I would read scripture and deliver a sermon. After a closing hymn, I would pronounce the benediction, and then I would leave and conduct the service at the big church. The lone usher, the young 65-year-old man of the congregation, Richard, would take the offering every Sunday. This took all of 30 seconds, barely enough time for the pianist, when she was there, to play one verse of one hymn. Richard would sit, fold his arms, and I would begin the sermon. Preaching in such a small church to such a small group of people feels much more like preaching in your living room than in a church. I stood in the chancel behind a small pulpit. The chancel was raised several feet, and the pulpit was on the right side as I looked at the congregation. So the 12 or so people attending would be directly in front of the pulpit. Every Sunday, and I mean this literally, there were no exceptions, two men would fall asleep almost as soon as the sermon began. One was a 90-year-old retired veterinarian, and the other was the youngster, Richard. He would drop the collection plate at the altar, and he would retire, again quite literally, to his pew next to his wife. They sat on the front. Richard's wife, Geraldine, was country, and she carried herself with that air of a Southern lady who would not sweat but knew how if she needed to. She always dressed neatly in flowered prints of soft pastels accented with dainty lace. She kept her bouffed hair perfect. Indeed, I overheard her complaining about having to sleep in some sort of hairnet in order to maintain the puffy do that she would get at the beauty salon each week. She spoke slowly, softly, and with a rural drawl. Now, I don't consider myself the world's greatest orator. However, I'm not a monotone mumbler that keeps his head in his manuscript either. And, of course, while they didn't snore, I still hated seeing 20% of my congregation sleeping at Sunday. I would try to wake them from time to time. I would raise my voice in an opportune moment. And God said... Yet nothing, my big God, failed to move either chin off their chest. So I found another opportunity. I would lower my voice for dramatic effect and then raise it to a crescendo, hoping the contrast might stir them from their slumber. Softly I would read, "Son of man, can these bones become living people again?" "O sovereign Lord," I replied, "you alone know the answer to that." And then he said to me, "Speak a prophetic message to these bones and say..." And here would come the dramatic pause at the end of a quiet stage whisper until I would build my voice and continue reading, "Dry bones, listen to the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Look! I am going to put breath into you and make you live again." I did wonder what dreams I may have started for the gents, but I could not raise my sleeping congregants to life. Once I even stomped my foot and pounded the pulpit. The sermon didn't really call for it. I was just curious. Nothing. But that not-so-subtle attempt may have been the motivation for Geraldine to ask me the question she did and then to act. Next Sunday arrived, and I wanted to see just how good of a talking to poor Richard may have received. Offering done, Richard sits, folds his arms, and I can see a slight glaze already forming in his eyes. And so can Geraldine. Her head is hinged, and she keeps looking right and up to see if he's asleep. She could keep cadence with a car's turn signal. Asleep? 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 So far, Richard's holding it together. But then it happens. His chin hits his chest. Geraldine looks right and up. Asleep? What? Asleep? I see Geraldine's face scrunch slightly, and I can tell she's perturbed. I'm still giving my sermon, but just going through the motions because I'm hooked on the drama before me. Geraldine doesn't have to think for long. She winds up and hammers her elbow into poor Richard's rib cage, and this causes a huge from Richard as he has had the breath knocked out of him. He looks at Geraldine with a startled look like, "What are you doing, woman?" And then a sheepish look of recognition falls on him that says, "Oh, right, I fell asleep." Of course, I stopped preaching. The church was silent. I bit my lip so as not to add insult for poor Richard. And as Geraldine looked at me right in the eye, and she gave me a curt nod as if to say, "I took care of it." Carry on. And I thought, that was my best sermon ever.
Thomas Fraze currently serves at First Church of Mountain Home, Arkansas. He is married to Patty and has a daughter, Allison Revis, who is a real writer and has read for Tales from the South. Next on Tales from the South, it's a Catholic funeral for Jason Pennington in It's in the Box.
"Yes, Jason," the intercom voice interrupted. "Could you come up to my office? Pauline is bringing coffee." My boss, a Louisiana French priest, always talked business over coffee. I paused by the kitchen door on my way. Pauline had just finished scalding china cups and placing coffee accoutrement atop a silver tray. "Father Melasson loves his coffee," she told me. I let Pauline go ahead of me as she balanced the cargo expertly on one hand up the carpeted staircase. Father gestured me toward a massive Chippendale armchair and exchanged small talk with Pauline, who filled two cups with steaming dark chicory. "So, Jason, we have a funeral." He leaned back into the leather desk chair and explained that a certain well-heeled gentleman had died. Mr. César Theodolphe Delahousse, notable Galvez chapter, son of the American Revolution. "Mrs. Clarice Delahousse has requested that her brother, the Monsignor Alphonse Lafontaine of New Orleans, be the celebrant. He's what we'd call in the seminary a loose cannon." The visiting priest had been staying at the rectory guest quarters for a little over a week. The staff had seen him ambling through the neighborhood around the church in the evenings, reading from a tattered breviary. How he avoided tripping on the uneven sidewalk and landing headfirst in the neighbor's azaleas was God's own mystery. "Monsignor's grandniece, Elaine Lafontaine Nunez, will sing," Father Melasson continued. "As you know, she's a fixture of the funeral circuit." In that part of the world, there exists a gaggle of professional singers who specialize in funeralizing. They travel heavy, trailing bulky roller bags packed with sheet music from church to church, to funeral chapel each day, ready within 24 hours to sing your loved ones to heaven with Catholic standards in Latin or French, the country top 10, or the latest pop ballads. "Furthermore, Jason, we'll start punctually tomorrow. The family have chosen Rostand and Charters. La Cassine Funeral Home, the other mortuary in town, was infamous for wretched timing. If it's La Cassine, they'd say, you'll be late for your own funeral." It was a society affair. Black-clad notables in stilettos and matching hats hovered into the church, genuflecting gracefully at pew ends like Degas ballerinas. Husbands lumbered in behind. Elaine appeared as I hoisted the organ's heavy roll top. The church was already at half capacity, and we still had an hour till curtain. Folks came early because today promised to be memorable. As I prepared to start the prelude, a red-faced and trembling altar boy crept up to the organ and caught my attention. "Mr. Jason, Monsignor, the Monsignor needs help. He's fussing like a polecat." I turned to Elaine. Oh, Uncle Alphonse, she commented, raising a single eyebrow. I followed the unsettled boy to the sacristy. You, organist, I need a cassock and vestments. Nothing here fits. He pointed with a fat, stubby index finger into the vesting closet, whose doors he had flung open and whose contents he had rifled through, cassocks hanging askew, lace-edged chapel surplices dangling off hangers from one shoulder. La Fontaine was short, as round as he was tall. I handed the raging Monsignor his best vesting option from our collection, along with a cincture. Put this on. Use the cincture to gather up the extra length and tie it all up high. I demonstrated the old choir robe trick and instructed the server to help the sputtering clergyman with his new duds. Police siren squawks signaled that the guest of honor had arrived. I could see through the glass doors of the church the sleek black hearse, four matching limousines, and the motor police, blue lights still flashing. The back hatch of the hearse swung open. Tootsie Rostand, chief funeral director, mustered a sullen murder of officious personnel as they rolled Mr. Cesar into the church. A blast from the organ cued Tootsie and his people to roll the bier down the aisle. Mr. Cesar was laid out in style, boxed up in a massive mahogany casket with ornate reliefs and sturdy columns. Enormous scrolled finials decorated each corner. The casework boasted flashy brass hardware. La Fontaine pushed the crucifer through the altar door. The old curmudgeon had not taken my fashion advice. Instead, he emerged in what appeared to be a mermaid-length cassock, which almost entirely concealed his shoes. As he went, he kicked the inside of the cassock, creating a momix-like bulge in the fabric with each stride. He carried the thurible himself, the coals already heaped with a choking mountain of incense, billowing a dense cloud of perfumed smog that mimicked the caustic plume of a westbound steam train. The congregation stood utterly transfixed by the sight. Nine steps lay between him and his brother-in-law. We glimpsed a wingtip as it beat the inside hem and went for the first step. He swayed left, then right. Lucky for all, the smoking orb provided adequate ballast to prevent the Monsignor from capsizing. It wasn't just a month before that an overzealous mother of the bride had set a course for adventure up these nine perilous steps, having snatched up her camera to sneak a few unofficial shots of the vows in progress. On the return trip, her new kitten heels slipped off step number 8, and she collapsed onto her rear, sliding down the following 7, coming to rest elegantly spread-eagle below, her chiffon skirt up over her head, and her control-top panties in plain view of all gathered there to witness. Tootsie Rostand stood sentry near Mr. Cesar, clutching the pall. Monsignor La Fontaine began, "We have this rosary to place atop the casket." He extended his palm to receive the requested object. Tootsie's face turned ashen. "We don't have a rosary?" Monsignor continued, once again extending his palm, "Now we have this crucifix." Tootsie shook his head vigorously. "What? We have no crucifix? We need to place the crucifix atop the casket." Monsignor Alphonse was wearing a tiny clip-on microphone, which rendered his raspy stage whisper audible to everyone. I don't understand why we don't have these items, he muttered. Tootsie, a possessor of that unique undertaker's charism that somehow made even the most bizarre funeral snafu seem convincingly planned, leaned in to Uncle Alphonse and smoothly instructed the aimless clergyman. You told me to place the items in the casket. The priest looked at Tootsie with disbelief. Well, we need to open the lid and get them out. We need them here. Tootsie's lips became animated as if electrified. The casket is sealed. We can't open it now. After about a minute of dumbfounded silence, Uncle Alphonse continued as if what had just happened had never happened at all. And now we place this pall. I turned to Elaine. She caught my glance and whispered, "Bless his heart." I'm still not sure to this day whether she meant Uncle Alphonse or Tootsie Rostan. After the graveside in the parish cemetery, I met Father Melançon in his study for a cup of Pauline's hefty brew. Suddenly, a harsh bzzz ensued from outside the office window. Assembled were four or five workmen near the Delahousse tomb. In their midst, Mr. Cesar's mahogany death ark. One of the men brandished a tape measure and was gauging the width of the tombeau's opening. Then he walked to the casket, measured it corner to corner, and pointed. Another man, holding a buzz saw, flipped the switch and proceeded to amputate large chunks from the ornate carvings. Cesar's ship was too wide for its final port. Soon, after all that sawing and forcing, the casket, looking less now like a French Baroque sideboard and more like a cleaned and shucked pineapple, slid smoothly into its narrow house with room enough on the end for the workmen to pitch in the hunks of wood they'd buzzed away. Monsignor Alphonse Lafontaine of New Orleans remained at the parish rectory for one more week. He continued his daily walks through the neighborhood, praying from his breviary while miraculously avoiding the shrubbery. Nearly 6 days after his brother-in-law's funeral, Father Alphonse himself fell sick at the rectory and died hours later at Our Lady of Prompt Succor Hospital. Tootsie Rostan draped that same pall over his plain casket the next day. Both his crucifix and his rosary were inside with him, per his request.
Jason Pennington grew up in Little Rock and has been the organist and choir master of St. Luke's Episcopal in North Little Rock since 2013. He has worked as a church organist and music director for over 30 years in Central Arkansas and South Louisiana. After attaining an MA from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, he taught English, German, and Latin at Catholic High School for Boys in Little Rock for 3 years before relocating to Cajun country for 14 years as a full-time church musician. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. Additional support provided by UALR School of Mass Communications, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, Little Rock Soiree Magazine, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
That must speed jellicles jam don't shake like that. And the speed jellicles jam don't shake like that. And she's looking mighty fine, she's dancing in a cowboy hat. Well, she ties her hair up high and she shimmies down low. And she finds her hair up high and she shimmies down low. And she's looking mighty fine and she's ready to live and go, go, go. She's a catch me out,
she's a catch me out.
Dogs growl wild,
dog.
She's everything that a country boy would need. And look here, boy, she's a staring back at me. Walmart towel, Bart Angel.